can't pay that high rent on your apartment? Guess what? You've got a lot of company. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the pandemic is making affordable housing even tougher to find in Florida these days. We'll look at the latest numbers and take your calls, too. Is the rent too damn high for you? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a new poll is out of faith voters across the state. Why more evangelicals and Catholics, some of them, are starting to swing their support towards Joe Biden. We'll take a look. But first this morning, the state's Department of Health Wednesday added 19 more deaths to this area's death toll from COVID-19. Now, that said, the number of newly reported cases on the First Coast remains stable. Duval County recorded 121 new cases of COVID and 10 deaths, but the rate of new positive cases is the same, about 3.65%. The state also reported 22 new cases and one new death in Clay County, 30 new cases and one death in St. John's, 18 new cases and four deaths in Nassau County. So to provide a little context to this, the death toll keeps ticking up, although the positive case rate remains about the same, but we'll continue to track these numbers. Amidst the pandemic, a new report says Florida is sliding even deeper into an affordable housing crisis. The need for access to stable, affordable housing has become more glaring than ever during this extraordinary time we're in, and it's going to remain an issue once the pandemic finally ends. But here's the reality right now in Jacksonville and in Florida's other large cities. There are just simply not enough affordable apartments out there. What's driving this? Let's find out. Amanda Gill is the Government Affairs Director with the Florida Apartment Association. She's in Orlando and she's on the line. Hi, Amanda.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And here's our question to callers. Are you having trouble paying your rent? Give us a call. Tell us your stories. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So, Amanda, you studied the metros of Jacksonville, Miami, Orlando, and Tampa, and found that rent costs are just too high in all of those cities. What's driving the cost of high rent across Florida? Why is it so tough to find affordable housing?
Absolutely. Well, overall, our study identified four key factors that are driving the cost of apartment rents here in Florida, and that's rapid economic and population growth. Jacksonville was one of the areas in the U.S. that had the most booming population in the entire U.S., so that's an important factor to keep in mind as well. In addition, zoning practices that limit the development of multifamily housing is also a factor. So those were all factors that we looked at, and rising land and construction costs, of course. But last but not least is municipal policies at the local level that often have a direct correlation to increasing rent prices.
Wow. Okay. So this is really a crisis. It was a crisis to begin with. But with the pandemic and so many people out of work and can't get unemployment, this is a five-alarm fire now. How is this impacting people's ability around the state to get housed?
Absolutely. Well, of course, you know, rental prices in Jacksonville were actually starting to cool prior to the pandemic. The average price in Jacksonville right now is $1,130 a month for rental prices in the area. Of course, this is also contributing to people's access to affordable housing, but although these challenges have been in place, you know, decades in the making here in Florida, our report really encourages local governments to evaluate the decisions that they're making at the local level and how those are actually going to correlate to increasing rent prices. For example, our study looked at a tax increase in Jacksonville of about 15%, which would result in a roughly 3% increase in someone's rent or $43 additional month rent that would be added on top of the cost that they're already paying. So as you can see,
wait a minute. Go back. You're advocating that we raise taxes in Jacksonville by 15% to help people with rent. Is that what you said?
No. I'm saying that a decision that's made at the local level to increase property taxes would actually result in someone's rent going up by $43 a month.
Got it. Okay, so, and property tax hikes are a political football here. They're not popular, although it's been raised time and again, but there's no political will to really do that here, at least not right now. So then what should officials in this community do? What policy tools do they have at their disposal that could make rent more affordable for more people in Jacksonville?
Absolutely. Well, one idea is, relaxing zoning restrictions. Jacksonville, actually 90% of the land in the area is zoned for single-family housing development, which limits multifamily housing construction across the board in the area. So one idea is to, relax some of those restrictions. Another idea is to perhaps provide some sort of incentive at the local level, perhaps a property tax discount for affordable housing units. Property taxes, as you can imagine, are one of the largest bills that a housing provider pays each year. So that's another key idea that could result in lowering rents in the area.
And how do you work with apartment owners? You're the Florida Apartment Association. And obviously they're going to say, look, I'm just charging what the market will bear. How do you incentivize the people that own apartment complexes to put out a market rent that's more affordable for more people?
Well, I think an important thing to keep in mind is that apartment owners and operators, they are typically managing an asset for an owner that expects a certain rate of return on that investment. So the quickest way to really bring down the cost of housing in the area, of course, is going to be to build more housing. Within the last 12 months, Jacksonville has seen about 4,000 new units come online. And obviously that's great, but development in the area is already starting to slow down. And we know with COVID-19 that it's making an even more negative impact on the development market. So I think it's important to keep those factors in mind and for local governments to incentivize the construction of affordable housing.
We're talking with Amanda Gill of the Florida Apartment Association. Their new study shows that the affordable housing crisis in Florida is more stark than ever in this pandemic and recession we're in now. So let us know, are you having trouble making your rent? What are your questions about the high cost of rent in Jacksonville and around the state? 549-2937. Rusty on the west side. Hey, Rusty, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Through the fixed-use zoning that was just mentioned, we've built an America, really, where the gated golf course community is the gold standard. And, if you so much as open your mouth to critique this system, you're un-American. You're suddenly in league with both Bernie Sanders and the devil. So, and your intelligence will be questioned. I think with this gap that we're going to see the return of the 19th century rooming house. That's all.
The 19th century rooming house or boarding house. Yeah. Amanda, we're already seeing that in some places around the country, including the neighborhood of Springfield. That's my neighborhood in Jacksonville. There are places like this springing up. And, that's not necessarily a good thing. It's just simply a makeshift solution that's sort of happening in an ad hoc way. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think the biggest barrier to really providing affordable housing is, and the caller just sort of touched on this a little bit, is the not in my backyard mentality, where the idea is that, we're looking for those beautiful, large homes and gated community. And unfortunately, that housing system is out of reach for some Floridians, especially in various metros across our state. And so I think it's important that we really address the not in my backyard mentality that oftentimes really blocks the development of multifamily housing, which is much more affordable for the average family in Florida.
Right. People theoretically say they support it, but the minute it goes up in their neighborhood, they throw up all kinds of barriers. How do we get people past that? That's an ongoing issue.
Absolutely. Well, I think the biggest thing is that it's a common misconception that the construction of multifamily housing, especially affordable housing, will bring down property values, and studies have shown that the exact opposite is true. In fact, most of the times, if an apartment community has affordable housing apartments in it. You cannot even tell from the outside. The properties are beautiful with pools and amazing amenities. And oftentimes it's a mix of both affordable units and market rate units. And so these properties are actually bringing up the value of the property in the area. And they're also contributing a significant amount of money to the city's tax base, which is an important point.
What's the base rent in Jacksonville? Do you have that number, Amanda? The average rent?
Yeah, it's the average rent in the Jacksonville area is $1,130 right now.
For a one bedroom?
Yes.
Yeah, for a one bedroom. The average worker cannot get even close to that number. So they double, they triple up, right?
Well, in some cases that's happening, yes. But again, you know, what we would say is to drive down the cost of housing, the key is really to build more multifamily housing. Mm-hmm. The challenge right now, because 90% of Jacksonville's area is, you know, zoned exclusively for single family.
Right. Okay. Let's go to Powers on the north side. Powers, hello. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ms. Melissa. How are you?
All right, thanks. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. My question is, why does the rent keep going up every year, no matter what? You always know that your rent going to go up the following year. I've been in Florida for like 20, 25 years. I'll take my ass off there.
Okay. Thank you, Powers. Yes, I mean, the rent gets raised. I mean, you can count on that, right, Amanda? Rent's going to keep going up unless you have a lucky rent stabilized situation.
Absolutely. Well, it goes back to, you know, what we started talking about at the beginning of the program of Jacksonville has seen significant population growth. And in fact, a lot of the population growth in that area has been from high income households. Our report actually found that households in Jacksonville earning more than $100,000 a year grew by 85% since 2010. So that factor is driving the development of certain housing products in Jacksonville as well.
Thanks for that. We're talking about a new study looking at the housing affordability crisis in Florida. With the average rent of a one-bedroom in Jacksonville at over $1,100 a month, many cannot afford housing. Where are you in all of this? Give us a call, First Coast 549-2937, as we speak with Amanda Gill of the Florida Apartment Association. Andrew is in Pecan Park. Hi, Andrew. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm a landlord, I just wonder, do they really understand that, you know, it's not just the landlord that's raising the rent, mm-hmm. because annually, your taxes automatically go up. You know, your insurance goes up because of whatever is out there. The new tax laws that came into view make sure that even if you have ELOCs on your property, if you take out a new mortgage on your home, you can't even write it off on your taxes, even if you're doing things to keep up the property or make sure that your renters have a decent place to live in and stuff like that. You know, I charge below the rental rate that goes up on Zillow and stuff like that.
Right. And how many units do you have, Andrew?
I have three units. I have one in Orange Park and two in Arlington.
And these are apartments.
Single family. Yeah.
Single family homes. Okay.
Right. And I make sure I go out of my way to make sure that the people that rent from me are not living in something that I wouldn't want to live in myself. Desperately try to. I don't even look at really just making a profit off of it.
Can I ask what you charge for a single family monthly rent?
Well, the highest I charge is $1,600 for a 3,000 square foot home.
Okay, $1,600 a month. Okay, that's about normal, I think, or about average. And Andrew, I hear you, and I appreciate your perspective. Thank you for the call.
Yeah,
I want to have Amanda respond to that. Amanda, what about someone like Andrew, who's on the other side of this equation? He's trying to offer a fair rent to people looking to get into a single family home, but he's being pressured by economic factors too.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's, you know, something a lot of people don't know is that just 9 cents of every dollar of rent actually goes back to the owner of that property. The rest of the money just like the caller was saying, you know, goes to important things like maintenance and property taxes and ongoing expenses and insurance and things of that nature, all of which our members are seeing, you know, insurance premiums go up as well, just as he noted. So these challenges are also contributing to the price of housing here in Florida, no doubt.
So how do we bring that cost curve down for landlords? How do we make the whole process of renting to folks a little more palatable? Because obviously you could hear the stress in his voice too.
Absolutely. Well, I think the key is for local governments to really consider the factors that are within their control, and certainly something like property tax increases and potentially property tax incentives for affordable housing. That's an area where local governments can really play a meaningful role in helping housing providers address this crisis. The other side of it, once again, is really just removing the barriers and allowing more housing to be built, because if there's a greater supply of housing, it's going to address the demand and prices will go down.
Eric on the South Side. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Melissa, why the negative comment about rooming houses?
Oh, I don't think they're negative so much as I think they're sort of an ad hoc solution.
Pardon?
I think they're sort of a patchwork solution to this.
Melissa, you said they were not a good thing. You just said that. Rooming houses are not a good thing. Why did you say that?
Do you have one? Is that why you're upset about this?
No, I do not have one. I want you to answer my question, please.
Because they're not regulated, because they're often run by slumlords, because they can charge exorbitant rent for people that are in desperate situations. There's a number of reasons why they might not be the best solution. But what do you think?
Let's hear them. I want to hear what you say. You made the comment.
I just told you.
Why are they not a good thing?
All right, Eric.
Huh?
All right, thanks a lot. I just told you why. Bruce and Yuli. Go ahead, Bruce.
So I was curious why the opportunity legislation that was passed about 3 years ago as part of the tax rollback bill hasn't resulted in more investment in affordable housing. It provides significant tax benefits to investors, and we just haven't seen anything. Can anyone shed some light on that for me, please?
Amanda, what about Bruce's question?
So I can't speak to that legislation specifically, but I can tell you the biggest reason why it's difficult to get affordable housing out of the ground is because, unfortunately, the numbers just don't pencil out for the folks who are building that housing to get the rate of return on that investment. And in order to build affordable housing, you know, developers need to get that funding from various investors, and those investors expect a certain rate of return, and they like to put their money where the lowest amount of risk is. And as you can imagine, sometimes if you're trying to build an affordable housing community, sometimes you face backlash in the community and getting that development actually approved. And so oftentimes the numbers don't pencil out, and it becomes more risky to try to build affordable housing because it might not get approved at the local level for it to actually be built.
I want to ask you as a follow-up, Amanda, about we took a couple of calls about rooming houses, and the most recent caller sounded a little angry that there had been some concerns expressed about them. Where is the Florida Apartment Association on that?
So we have not taken a position on rooming houses. What I can say is that we are supportive of housing opportunity and diversity in the market. And so obviously our members are bringing diversity to the market. Some are building micro apartments, which are, you know, obviously on a much smaller scale and typically more affordable as well. So they're trying to bring a vast array of products to the market that can serve the different income needs as well as just personal preference for an apartment home.
All right. Lots of feedback on social media. Robert emails the show. Please point out Jacksonville is among the most affordable big cities in the U.S. and the most affordable in Florida. Let's keep things in perspective. Incentives for building affordable housing are key, and we need federal, state, and local government to encourage that, he says. On Facebook, so much feedback. Here's one from a listener. In 1999, my rent in Riverside was $285 a month, and I made $12 an hour at a call center. Wages have gone up maybe 5%, but my rent has quadrupled, she says. Hope writes, We need buyout programs for those who will be displaced by climate impacts. Look at the residents of Kenknight Drive. They have to be removed due to flooding, but where will they find affordable housing in this city? They need to be paid not what their homes are worth, but what it will take to resettle. I know two families evicted over a year ago, and they are still living on people's couches as they are on waiting lists for affordable housing. Amanda, that is a reality. People will wait a long time to get on a list so that they can get into an affordable unit because there just aren't enough of them.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, your point about wages in Florida remaining relatively stagnant is definitely something that we're seeing as well. Again, you know, it's just important to keep in mind land costs have gone up 5% since 2012, and we've also seen construction costs that have increased annually over 3%, which is 68% faster than inflation. All of these things are really contributing to the cost of housing, and they're driving it up much faster than wages are increasing.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Developers dress up affordable housing to receive the tax benefits and get approval at the local level, but the housing is far from affordable. What do you think about that, Amanda?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, because typically if they're getting a tax incentive, they're required to have rent remain affordable for a certain specified period per the funding that they get. So I think that that's important to keep in mind as well. And that's another reason, going back to our study, which pointed out it would be helpful for a property tax incentive to exist for affordable housing, which would help affordable housing not only be built here in Florida, but also remain affordable going forward, because it would have a tax incentive that housing providers could access going forward.
And here's an email from Kelsey. Is the solution for state or federal governments to subsidize or provide grants to developers to ensure that their return on investment is equitable to investors? Is that...
Absolutely.
You think so, yes.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that directly correlates with our idea of providing some sort of property tax offset for affordable housing, you know, incentivizing it with low interest rate loans as well. That's another idea. But really, it's just a way for local governments to come together and help the housing providers and development community address this problem. They simply can't address it on their own. They need the support from local governments in the form of funding like that to make it work.
Ashley is in San Marco. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Hey. Thank you. Good morning. I am a single mom with children, and trying to find affordable housing is impossible. And I finally found a place that I could afford, but trying to get my landlord to fix things has become impossible. So I'm like stuck between kind of living halfway, you know, decently, or living out of my means. I mean, for example, I went 2.5 months without air conditioner, and now I don't have a refrigerator. Mm. And so it's really hard to get him to do something about it.
Well, and what's your rent? Are you, you're renting in San Marco?
I am renting in San Marco. My rent is $875.
Okay. Well, at least it's below $1,000, and you can make that, right?
Yes. And thankfully, it's below $1,000, but I'm also shelling out extra money because I'm not able to live in a... you know, with a space that has air conditioning because it broke and I couldn't get a hold of him. So,
wow.
You know, I've had to shell out extra money.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that.
Something mm-hmm. that I shouldn't have to be maintaining.
Sure.
And so that's frustrating.
Sure. So much frustration out there. Ashley, thank you for the call. And I'm sorry to hear that. No one should have to go without AC in Florida ever. Amanda, where can people learn more about this study, and how can they get involved in this whole issue more deeply?
Absolutely. Well, a full copy of the report is available on the Florida Apartment Association's website, which is faahq.org. So you can get a full copy of the report there. And if folks are looking to get involved, the Florida Apartment Association is going to be continuing to talk about this issue, especially as we look to the 2021 legislative session. So please stay tuned for more from us on that.
All right. Amanda Gill, she's Government Affairs Director with the Florida Apartment Association. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still to come. Meanwhile, later we will pop in on the 904 pop-up coming up at the beaches. But up next...
Since 2016, more than 11% of evangelical and Catholic voters are going to be voting for Joe Biden.
A new poll of religious voters in swing states like Florida shows some trouble for President Trump. That's after this. And please support WJCT with your pledge.
Aristotle used to talk about this concept he had. It was about how humans interacted with each other. He called it politics. I'm Domenico Montanaro, and in public radio, no matter what the political news cycle brings, we never lose sight of the fact that politics is still all about people. So do some politicking of your own, help your fellow humans interact with high-quality news and information by donating to this NPR station now.
Please call 353-9528 or visit WJCT.org.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. Well, a new survey of evangelical and Catholic voters in key five battleground states, including Florida, shows President Trump's perceived lack of kindness is driving faith voters away, potentially in large enough numbers to affect the outcome of the election. Now, the poll was commissioned by the evangelical group Vote Common Good. I learned more from their executive director, Pastor Doug Padgett. Hi, Doug. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it was really my pleasure.
So you did a poll of swing state faith voters, Catholics and evangelical Christians, in five key states, including Florida. What did you find?
You know, we found really interesting results that since 2016, more than 11% of evangelical and Catholic voters are going to be voting for Joe Biden in comparison to the ones who voted for Hillary Clinton. And that's a massive swing. And some of those are people that moved away from voting for Donald Trump, and some are those who just sat out the election altogether.
And these are voters in Wisconsin, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. You chose those swing states. What was the reason this group of voters gave you for why they might have voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but they're not going to support him in 2020?
The primary reason that came out of the poll was Donald Trump's lack of kindness and his incompetence to perform the duties as president. And that was encouraging to those of us who are trying to help move these voters, and because we work for an organization that wants to help faith voters make a different choice in 2020 than they did in 2016. But we were really surprised at just how powerful the fact of Donald Trump's unkindness actions were to these voters.
They don't perceive him as, I guess, sharing their Christian values. Now, in Florida, the survey found actually a 13-point swing from Trump to Biden among evangelical voters. That might take some people by surprise because the president's base of evangelical support has been rock solid for his presidency. So your numbers are showing something different, yes?
Yeah, we're noticing that there's a move, and part of the reason that we've been working to reach out to evangelical faith voters and to poll them is because we know that they've been a significant part of Donald Trump's base. But the base is fracturing, and it's weakening, and Donald Trump has earned that fracture. He has just continued to behave in ways that work so much against the ethics, the morals, and the standards of so many voters. Now, this doesn't mean that the majority of evangelicals won't be voting for Donald Trump. That likely will be true in Florida and in other states. But to lose this number of voters at this point in the election season is a significant shift.
Now, in Florida, the evangelical vote is important. But in some of the other states you polled, the Catholic vote can be key, particularly in Midwestern states. Tell me a little bit about the Catholic vote in this survey and what Catholic voters had to say.
Yeah, Catholic voters were one of the largest groups to move away from supporting Donald Trump. It was a significant movement of people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 as Catholics and won't be voting for him again in this election in 2020. And again, it was the issue of kindness that was the top of the list. But we actually, our poll asked for the voters to rate both Joe Biden and Donald Trump on issues of Christian virtues and vices, sort of taking the Christian morality question seriously. And Donald Trump was rated low below Joe Biden in every category of Christian virtue and higher in every category of Christian vice than Joe Biden. And we think that had a lot of the reason for Catholic voters to change their vote.
Okay. Now, often voters of faith, particularly evangelical voters, will tell a pollster, look, I'm not a fan of the president's demeanor, his tweets, his what I see is his personal immorality. However, I'm pro-life, so I'm going to support him because of his position on abortion. That's come up a lot in the polling. Did that is that a factor in your poll? Are people now overlooking the abortion issue and choosing to vote for Joe Biden, even though they don't see eye to eye with him on this issue?
What we believe is happening is that these evangelical voters are returning back to a voting pattern that was more similar with Barack Obama, where they may have disagreed with Barack Obama on positions, but could support him as a person and as a leader. And that would seem to be happening with these voters in 2020, that they are, while they might agree with Donald Trump's stated position on issues like abortion.
So what about the Supreme Court, though? Certainly conservative voters have supported President Trump because they believe that he will appoint conservative justices to the Supreme Court, and he has, that they see as being more likely to overturn or weaken Roe versus Wade.
Many of the voters who think that the Supreme Court has been the primary offering that Donald Trump has given them, they were quite disappointed in the recent decisions by the Supreme Court, including by justices that Donald Trump had appointed, and that the issue of gay marriage and the issue of hiring or firing a person based on their sexual preference was not what they wanted the outcome to be. So many of these voters are now realizing that the bribe, basically, that Donald Trump gave them to accomplish what they wanted on the Supreme Court was not being fulfilled. Now we believe that they're moving to other issues that they also know are important for the president, like how the president conducts himself and the way that the president chooses to lead.
Now, your organization is called Vote Common Good. You are going to do a swing state bus tour, including rallies in Florida, to reach out to voters of faith. What will the message be?
Right, we do our outdoor socially distanced rallies and events in Florida, and we're asking voters to make the common good their voting criteria, to consider that they would not only consider their political preference, but what would be good for the country. And we say to Republicans all the time, we're not asking you not to be a Republican. We are asking you as a Republican to not vote for this man in this election, because it just violates so much of what you feel is important to you as a voter, and if you're a person of faith, as a person of faith.
You've also partnered with the anti-Trump Republican group, the Lincoln Project, Never Trump Republicans. What is that partnership entailing?
Yeah, in so many ways, what the Lincoln Project does to say to Republicans that they need to deepen into their sense of being a Republican and finding that Donald Trump doesn't satisfy that at all for them is very similar to what we're saying to faith voters, that we want them to consider their faith in their vote and to make sure that their commitments to their voting fulfill both their faith commitment as well as their sense of political identity. And many of these faith voters and many of these Republicans find themselves without a home. And one of the things that we're doing is similar to what the Lincoln Project does, and that is to consider how powerful it is to find a home inside of their voting with others who consider their faith or their Republican identity as important.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. He's Pastor Doug Padgett, Executive Director of Vote Common Good. Thanks for this information.
Thank you.
Well, this Saturday, Boys and Girls Clubs across America are celebrating a special day for kids. Paul Martinez is president and CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Northeast Florida, and he's got a preview for us. Hey, Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well. It's good to hear your voice. So you're a former boys club kid yourself, right? You come by this job honestly.
Exactly. Although I've been in Jacksonville over 50 years,
yeah.
When I grew up in New York, I went to the South Queens Boys Club. My brother and I went every day from when I was 7 years old to when I was 13 years old. And it made a huge impact in my life.
Right. It's an amazing after school and anytime program for kids across the country, including in our area. Now, you've got a big day coming up Saturday. It's the National Boys and Girls Clubs Day for Kids. What's happening this weekend?
Well, it's pretty much, we have 4,500 Boys and Girls Clubs throughout the country. And it's a day where we really, it's really a fun day for everybody. And there's really no programming at hand. It's just everybody just have fun. Part of our mantra is it's kind of like a three-legged stool: safety, fun, and education. But this weekend we're going with the fun component, everything from flying kites to sports to outdoor stuff. So it'll be a lot of fun. We're looking forward to it.
And is this happening at all of your clubs around the region?
All the clubs throughout the country, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So people can just pick their location and get out and have some fun with their kids. But in addition to the Day of Fun Saturday, you have a lot of initiatives happening, including a partnership with the Children's Home Society of Northeast Florida. Tell us about that.
Well, we're excited about that. It really brings in a great partnership. You know, a lot of times nonprofits have the reputation of being in silos, and this is just the opposite. We're working with the Children's Home Society, UNF, FSCJ, Duval County Public Schools, and Agape, all for the good of kids. And it started, I think it was about a year ago, we went and visited a community school in Orlando at Orlando Evans High School, where they had a Boys and Girls Club inside the school. And it's just a great way to deliver services to our kids. So we started, last week was the grand opening of our Ed White High School Boys and Girls Club.
So when kids come there, they have access to a whole range of services. Can you tell us what all is on the menu?
Yeah, so this started about a year ago when we opened up, actually about a year and a half ago, when we opened up the City Teen Center in Springfield. It's about a 20,000 square foot facility just set up for teenagers. And once we started showing that place around, there were a lot of people interested in it. So the opportunity at Ed White presented itself through the Kids Hope Alliance and through the Children's Home Society. So they had about 5,000 square feet of unused, it was storage space when we looked at it. It had a bunch of old tables and chairs, and we decided we wanted to turn that into a Boys and Girls Club, and we did just that. So we went in, and first thing we do is we talk to the kids about what they want, what type of programming that they're interested in. And it ended up being a recording studio, a dance studio, computer lab, robotics and drones, a barbershop, a game room, and virtual reality. So it really is a place to behold, and the kids absolutely love it.
I bet. This is an amazing after-school resource, because we know from so many studies that have been done on this is that period after school, 3 to 6 p.m., that can be a dangerous time for kids. They need structure and they need activities, and that's really where you're focused, isn't it?
Exactly. When you look at Duval County, we have 128,000 kids that go to Duval County Public Schools, and about 80% of them are on free and reduced lunch, which I was one of those free and reduced lunch kids back in the day. And so that leaves about 100,000 kids that, in essence, don't have a place to go after school. So once you start adding all of the providers, the Boys and Girls Club, PAL, communities and schools, the YMCA, all of those great organizations, collectively we serve maybe 10 to 12,000 kids a year through the Kids Hope Alliance. So it's not that we don't have great programs in Jacksonville. I don't think we have enough of them. And you're right, that time between 3 and 6, if we're not taking care of them, they have opportunities with gangs, and that's what we try to combat the most.
And so how do you entice a kid to walk through your doors who they might feel uncomfortable, they might think it won't be any fun? How do you get them in the door?
Well, we have a waiting list. We don't have any problems with that.
Oh, that's great.
We serve kids from 6 to 18 years old. And, 6 and 7-year-old kids are actually really up to 10 or 12. They still pay attention. There's great hope for them. It's when they get to that teenage stage, if you have a teenager at home, or if you know, that's when they know everything already. So we have to come with a better game, if you will, and entice them with all of the great programming and all of the things that they usually don't get or have access to it at home. So when you hear stuff about a barbershop or robotics or drone labs, that's pretty much to get the kids in the facility. Once we're there, we put a caring, loving adult that's been trained by the Boys and Girls Club, by Kids Hope Alliance, and only at that time can we start to build a bond. And because kids are real, teenagers are very, they're non-filtered nowadays. So if they're not having fun or it doesn't seem interesting, they're not going to come.
They vote with their feet.
So after they're there and they develop the bond with one of our staff members, that's when they can find out really what's going on in the life of that child. And then we can direct them as to where we believe that the resources are there that would best suit them.
This is all such great news, and I want to give you all the kudos in the world, Paul, for your strong leadership and all of these new initiatives. And so with all of that said, Saturday is the day, the National Boys and Girls Clubs Day for Kids this Saturday. You can go to the website bgcnf.org for more. You encourage everyone to come out, right?
Exactly. It would be a great day.
So come on out and support the Boys and Girls Club. He is CEO Paul Martinez. Paul, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for your time, Melissa. Appreciate it. Take care.
Again, that's Saturday. And in a moment, we're going to tell you about another fun event coming up at the beaches this month, the 904 pop-up. We'll explain right after this.
I'm Kenya Young, executive producer of Morning Edition. I love a really well-done show in the morning. You can't have all politics. You can't have all international news. You can't have all feature stories. You should be able to get a little bit of everything within each half hour of the two-hour show. And that makes a difference. And so I plan very carefully. I will move pieces. I will take pieces off of the show and put other pieces in. Each day, our goal is to deliver something that you didn't know. We want to leave you thinking. So I do donate to my hometown member station. I just know how important it is to keep supporting the work. And our best work is done when it's supported by loyal listeners. I'm Kenya Young. Here's how you can support public radio.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpenn.com for more information.
UF Health Jacksonville, celebrating 150 years of caring for our community. Founded in 1870, UF Health Jacksonville is a major academic health center serving Northeast Florida and Southeast Georgia. Learn more at ufhealthjacks.org.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
It took 36 days and a Supreme Court decision before George W. Bush became the 43rd president.
The level of litigation that took place in 2000 was unprecedented.
I'm Elsa Chang. What was unprecedented then might seem quaint after this year's vote. The looming election legal battles this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Some will tell you crime in America is up. Others say it's down. Turns out, it depends on the type of crime. But as both presidential campaigns know, for a lot of people, it's not about the numbers. It's about how they feel. I'm Jen White. How well do the facts about crime align with our fears? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, you can close out the summer season with the 904 Pop-Up Summer Living. Now, this is Jacksonville's largest curated and socially distant pop-up event, and it features dozens of local creatives and vendors. It's all happening next Sunday, September 27th, out in Jacks Beach. Mark Braddock of 8103 Clothing, Inc. in Springfield is on the line to tell us all about it. Hey, Mark, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Good to have you on the show. So what exactly is the 904 pop-up?
The 904 pop-up is a local driven market, basically full of all creatives here from Jacksonville. It was a concept that was created inside of my store about a year and a half ago. The event grew from 10 vendors to over 80 vendors in less than 3 months. And the event is basically all about community over competition, everyone supporting each other, and strengthening our creative culture for Jacksonville as a whole.
And that's really important to you, to highlight local makers, local businesses. This is what this is all about, right?
100%. It's all about local and basically featuring all of our creatives, makers all across the board, local businesses that basically, are running the pulse, here in Jacksonville for our creative culture.
So when everyone comes out, they can take a look at everything that's for sale, learn about all of these businesses. There will be food trucks and fun. It's all coming up at the Seawalk Pavilion, not this Sunday, but next Sunday. Now, you had postponed it, right, and some other events you'd planned due to COVID. How excited are you to be back out there in the community?
It's great. We've definitely had to pivot due to the pandemic, for sure. We are under strict guidelines from the city of Jacksonville Beach and also, being compliant with CDC recommendations as well. All of our vendors are spaced out 10 feet from each other. They're all going to be provided with hand sanitizer and also face masks. We are encouraging, obviously, people, to not come if they have symptoms or they feel sick. This is an outdoor event. We have basically structured it to where we can keep it socially distant. And per the guidelines of the city of Jacksonville Beach, we are limited to the amount of people at one time at the actual event. And, it's just a lot of different hoops to jump through, but we're glad that we're back and that the momentum is out there again, and this is just all about supporting our local vendors so we can do this again.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about the vendors and some of the cool stuff we'll be able to see and buy.
So obviously we have a food truck village with some of the best food trucks in Jacksonville. We have What's the Catch, Pizza Brigade, El Cubano Jack, we have Hawaiian Island, Italian Ice, Kona Ice. Also, there will be a lot of clothing brands, men's and women's, all across the board. We have a lot of local boutiques here in Jacksonville that basically, you know, pop up and bring their selection from their store and come out there. We also have a lot of local artists, local businesses across the board, makers. I mean, there's basically something for everyone out there. If it, in regards to apparel, clothing, home, health and wellness, there's literally something for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, if you have gone regularly, say, to the Riverside Arts Market, this is your chance to enjoy that same kind of feel, but out at the beach. Now, this is coming up not this weekend, but next Sunday. It is free, right? And pet friendly too, Mark. People can bring their furry friends.
Yes, ma'am. This is a free event and it is pet friendly. Please bring your furry friends. We encourage that. And yes, it is definitely a similar concept to the Riverside Arts Market. Here at the 904 pop-up, we focus more on the cutting edge and bleeding edge for our creative community. And we'll, you know, you will come out and you'll see brands and companies that you might have not ever seen before here in Jacksonville.
Right. So get on that bleeding edge and mark your calendar for Sunday, September 27th. From 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Seawalk Pavilion in Jacksonville, it's the 904 Pop-Up Summer Living. Close out the summer with this free, curated, and socially distant pop-up event. It features more than 60 local makers, including the lead sponsor, 8103 Clothing in Springfield. And Mark Braddock, kudos to you for putting all of this together. I'm sure it's going to be beautiful that Sunday, weather-wise, and lots of crowds. Everybody make sure to wear your masks. Mark, thanks so much, and have a great time.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. She is always on the bleeding edge of trends, along with director Josh Torres. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep that feedback coming to us. We appreciate it. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock if you missed any part of today's show. Or our podcast is up every day wherever you listen to yours. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. In the meantime, have a great Thursday and keep wearing your masks, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.